All right. Welcome to the last day of TechEd, everyone. Glad you make it out of bed this morning. I know I had to a little bit earlier than you probably. My name's Nick Randall. For those who don't know me, I run a company called Built to Roam, pretty much exclusively focusing on Windows Phone. But I've had a history of sort of Windows Mobile, and then when that went down before Windows Phone went up, I sort of went in between and I went, well, what am I going to do with myself? So I went down the iPhone path and I went down the Android path and I've done some stuff across those platforms as well. I'm proud to say I'm back on Windows Phone because I still reckon it's probably the best platform to build for in terms of the development tools and in terms of getting stuff out into the market. So this session this morning is going to be a session where we're going to look at the different technologies that you can use to build across multiple platforms. It will have a Windows Phone skew to it. A lot of the demos will be Windows Phone. So if you're looking for an Android or an iPhone, then you're probably in the wrong conference. So this is primarily how to do cross-platform development, starting with Windows Phone and considering the other platforms. I mean, there's some other sessions that talk about using, you know, Knockout and other technologies to build for, say, WebKit and things like that. This is about how you do cross-platform with starting with Windows Phone, I guess. So we will look at the different mobile platforms and I guess where the industry is at. And then we'll look at various options around how you go about building cross-platform. Everything from web technologies all the way through to sort of native code. I'm not a native developer, so you won't see me hacking out some C or C++ code, but we'll try and have a look at the other things across the way. We'll then finish off with just a brief discussion of, I guess, around what frameworks and tools are out there that can really help you. Before we jump into it, let's look at some platform adoption. Now, this is heavily skewed by the fact that it's a survey that was done on developers. Okay, now developers are not particularly good representation of consumers, but they are the ones who tend to steer where applications get developed. So you can see this is based on 2010 figures. So you could use this as a sort of premonition of what developers are doing and where they're going to be investing their time. So it's interesting to see that obviously Android's at the very top there, which is interesting because back in early 2010, Android wasn't the major player in most markets. It was still predominantly iPhone and iOS. Okay, so it's interesting to see. Yes, absolutely. No, you're spot on. So that's the reason, I guess, developers build applications. So, you know, the fact that there's so many developers building means that there is a dearth of applications out there. They're not all great. And part of the problem that Android's going to be facing in the future is that they have to cull out those, or they have to try and work out the good, the bad, and way of differentiating them, right? So that's part of that problem, okay? The other interesting thing to look at is what developers think of the various different platforms. Okay, so you can see here that obviously Windows Phone does really well in terms of the technology and in terms of the tools that go with it and even the documentation, which is unusual for Microsoft. They don't normally get rated high on documentation. But interesting enough, on the other end of the spectrum, you've got iOS and Android where they rate it really high in terms of market penetration and in terms of the opportunity to make revenue, but they don't rate it particularly high at all in terms of the tools. Okay, so it's interesting to see the different end of the spectrum there. Okay, and then you've got some players like Symbian in there where, you know, there's obviously a large penetration in the market, but it's very difficult to make money out of it. Okay, sorry? I'm not sure that I can get any focus. The slides will be available afterwards. So for those who can't read it at the back, so the top row there is, or the top three rows are really looking at the commercial side of it. So the first one is market penetration, development tools, and revenue potential. Low-cost development tools and revenue potential. And going across, you've got Android, BlackBerry, iOS, Java ME, Mobile Web, Qt, Symbian, and Windows Phone / Windows Mobile. Do apologize if that's out of focus and you can't read it. Slides will be available after the session. Okay, now, whilst there are multiple platforms out there and multiple different technologies to build things with, we have to face the inevitable is that the web is where most platforms seem to be converging, okay, and particularly around HTML5 and the specifications that are going through the W3C. Now, this is a particularly interesting slide because it shows the range of different specs in the HTML5 group and where they're at in terms of going from working draft all the way through to a recommendation. Now, the reason why this is significant is that Microsoft continually gets hammered by the fact that IE9 doesn't support various parts of the HTML5 spec. Okay, and now, whilst on the desktop, that's okay, because if you want to use a certain part, that hasn't been ratified, then you can go down to the labs and you can install the plugin and off you go. Unfortunately, the mobile version of IE9 doesn't have that plugin architecture, so it means that, unfortunately, we're stuck with IE9 as it ships. Okay? The reason that they do that is that they don't want to invest in, say, something that's going through a working draft, only to discover that it changes or that it doesn't get ratified, and that the, and then all of a sudden they're stuck in the IE6 mentality, where we've got to support a broken bit of technology thereafter. Okay, so we really don't want to go down that path. Unfortunately, it does mean that Microsoft tends to be on the back step in terms of the web technologies on the mobile platform, which is why we end up with this. Okay, so you can see here that most of the other major platforms are doing rather well in terms of support for various HTML5 features. Unfortunately, Windows Phone doesn't so much, at least in the current version in the market. Now, when Mango gets released, and we actually saw an announcement today from the Windows Phone guys talking about the first Mango devices coming to the market from HTC, so that's pretty good. We're actually going to start to see them support a lot more of the HTML5 stuff in there. So the transition there is that the first version of Windows Phone was based on IE7, I should stop calling it Windows Phone Mango, it's Windows Phone 7.5, will be based on IE9. Okay, so it's pretty much the same code base that comes across. The major APIs that are used around mobile platforms are predominantly the geolocation and the web storage. Okay, so obviously Microsoft's trying to invest heavily into those APIs that are used primarily by web developers. Okay. So you can see that they've done quite a lot of work in the migration from effectively IE7 through to IE9. And we've got a lot of features, including, you know, HTML5 canvas all the way through geolocation. And one of the things you might have seen in, I think, Dave Glover's session, he would have shown the fish demo. And that's a good example of actually, not only do we have HTML5 support, we've actually got hardware acceleration for those features as well. The problem with web technologies is generally the UX always suffers from using those technologies, primarily because people are in this mentality that we're going to go from one page to another page, and each time we go from one page to another, we're going to go back to the server and refresh the page. Now, things have got a lot better over the last, you know, 5 years, where we've moved to, you know, we've incorporated a lot of Ajax into our applications, and we're starting to do less request response in terms of the whole page, and we're going to start to update individual things on the page. Okay. We're still at a problem where if we're going to build for mobile platforms, as distinct from the desktop, on the desktop, most users are happy to go to a website that doesn't look like the next website, and they're used to that fragmentation. On the mobile platforms, what they really want to see is they want to see applications that look and feel as if they belong on the platform. And that means using controls that are native to the platform. Okay, so if I've got an iOS application and I go page to page, I want the back button to be in the navigation bar. Okay, on the Windows Phone, I don't want that, okay, because I'm used to having a hardware back button. Okay, and similarly on Windows Phone, I'm used to having a panorama experience or a pivot experience. I want the same those same controls out of my web experience. Okay, so that's why when we look at the features that web developers are looking for in terms of building mobile applications, the two that come to mind are the ability to make it look like a native application. Okay, so reusing some of the native controls. Okay, and the second one is geolocation. Okay, that's really important for mobile applications because part of building a mobile application is that you don't, because you're constrained in terms of the resources on the device and the screen size, you want to only push up stuff that's really contextually aware for the user. Okay, so stuff that's relevant to where they are. Okay, obviously geolocation is a major part of that. The other thing that's interesting to look at in terms of developers is what their goals are in terms of or what drives them to pick a particular platform. And obviously one of the big ones here is market penetration. And increasingly, if you look at the US market particularly, you'll see that Android is doing phenomenally well over there. And again, it's chicken and egg. So that's really driving developers. And obviously, developers are getting on board on the platform, building great applications that, again, is driving the market. Here in Australia, we're in the unfortunate sense that we're being led by the iPhone market. Okay, they do have a dominant percentage here. And that was predominantly because we've actually got legislation here that limits Apple in the way that they can target particular telcos or particular markets. Okay, whereas in the US, they were able to go one carrier, lock it down, at least for a certain period. And that's actually crippled them in the US, but it's done really well for them over here. Unfortunately, it means that any other platform getting into the market here has taken a lot of long time. So we're only just starting to see Android really starting to come into its own here, and then hopefully Windows Phone will be there in the near future as well. The other thing to consider when you were building mobile applications or trying to work out what our strategy is going to be for building cross-platform applications is the full life cycle. It's all very well to have the great set of tools and technologies to build for a particular platform. Okay, then we think about multiple platforms and we go, okay, well, maybe we should build for the web because that way we can, you know, build it once and have, and just maybe reskin it or maybe style it slightly different for the different platforms. The problem then is, how do we make money out of it? Okay. All of a sudden, we've gone from having a model where I can build and publish an application, publish it via an app store, and actually they'll pay me some money once the application sells. Now, if I'm building a mobile website, all of a sudden I'm responsible for not only marketing it, I'm also responsible for selling it and doing all of the transactions on there. Okay, there's a very good reason why most app stores charge 30%. Okay, because they do international billing for you, and at the end of the day, all you have to worry about is how much money is coming into your account. Okay. There's a few tax papers and things like that that you've got to sign along the way, but once you've got all that process underway, at the end of the month, they just give you the money, okay? They don't, and you don't have to worry about all of those transactions and accounting for them, okay? That's part of the nice thing about app stores. Now, I think Apple's been a little bit greedy in pushing people to use them entirely for all of their internal transactions because there's no huge value add there, okay? Because at the end of the day, you've got to work out how you're going to do the subscription model or how you're going to transact those products. Okay, so Apple's not really adding a 30% of value there. Where they are adding the 30% value is when they actually sell the application for you and market it. Okay, so those are just some of the things to consider. I do apologize, this is kind of small. So again, grab the slides afterwards and you can actually have a look through all of those. So the majority of this session is really going to be looking at the different strategy we've got for going cross-platform. Okay. Now, rather than focusing on one specifically, I do want to give a bit of a breadth approach to this, but we will jump in and write some code as well. We'll start with mobile websites. So this is very much looking at existing websites that are out there and saying, okay, well, how can we take them to the mobile platform in the shortest possible time, okay, and get really good reach? And this is sort of almost a lowest common denominator approach because at the end of the day, you can actually scale this all the way down to very rudimentary devices, okay? It doesn't necessarily give you a good look and feel in terms of platform, okay? So, you know, you'll have to style it one way for one application or one platform and then style it again for another one. But even then, if you're going to invest a serious amount of time into there, you'll end up having to use native controls and stuff like that. And then you have to really consider whether that's the right option or whether you should be building specific applications for those platforms. So it's a really good approach for getting a breadth approach. Okay, what we're typically seeing with mobile websites is they've still got the mentality where we're on one page, we click on a button, and we go to another page. Okay, so as distinct from we're staying on one page and just rendering different content. Okay, so in the context of websites, that's what we're really talking about. In terms of Windows Phone, the question we keep getting asked is what the user agent string is. Okay, this is particularly relevant for mobile websites because they do a lot of the skinning on the backside, okay, so on the server side, and they'll do user agent detection and work out how they're going to reskin or how they're going to style it for the different platforms. Okay, so these ones are available online as well. So there's the RTM version, which is the current retail version, and then there's Windows Phone Mango. Okay, and you can see that as we shift between the two, we're going from IE7 through to IE9. There's one little gotcha for the new set of tools. If you're building a Windows Phone 7.0 project in the new set of tools, okay, you'll still get, even if you're running on a Mango device, you'll still get IE7 appearing as the user agent string. Okay. So just something to be aware of, whereas if you're building using the 7.1 SDK, okay, and targeting 7.1, then you'll actually end up with IE9 in the user agent string. Okay. Okay, so let me jump over and we'll show a quick example of using meta tags to actually take an existing website. I'll just run this little website up. Okay, that's website I've got nothing to do with. Okay, So it's a built our own website, and what I'm going to do is take this, and actually if you go to the site at the moment, you'll realize that there is no mobile version of it, which is quite ironic. And what we'll do is we'll actually style it so that it actually renders at least okay in the web browser on the mobile device. Okay, so if I actually run that now, what you'll see is it renders like that, okay, which is particularly hard to read, not only for you guys, but also even if I had actually run that on the device. Now, I can actually start to zoom into it, and, you know, if I actually load some content, I can drill in, and you'll notice that it's kind of a little nasty to navigate from a mobile perspective because it doesn't stay in the middle of the screen. It's hard for me to zoom in and actually read the content all on one screen. Okay, so let's actually go back and actually restyle this slightly. And where's my stop button gone? There we go. And so up here, we're just going to add a couple of meta tags into here. Now, the reason why there's three is because most of the modern browsers, mobile browsers, just require this line. So this is basically setting the viewport. So basically what you're doing is saying, okay, well, don't display the whole thing in one screen, just actually condense it down to, in this case, 320 pixels. Okay. The other two meta tags there are actually to support some of the older platforms. Okay. So if you're styling a website for older platforms, so a lot of the Symbian platforms, for example, you want to include those two tags just so that those will pick up those because they don't understand about the viewport meta tag. Okay. So I'll run this one. And we'll actually just hit the refresh button here. And you'll notice now that it's still got this bounciness around it, but it's at least rendering it so that it's easy to read in one screen. Okay, so it's all been condensed into a 320 pixel wide screen that we can see on without having to scroll left and right. Okay, well, we've still got this bounciness, and it still doesn't sit nicely in the screen. So there's another property that we can add in here, let me just stop this again. And now the reason why I keep stopping it is because I can actually never remember what the full text is. This one here, make sure you put a comma in there, not a semicolon, because whilst it will work on most platforms, if you actually run it up on IE Mobile, it won't actually pick up, it'll actually ignore the semicolon and everything after it, so it won't work properly, whereas on most other platforms, it'll actually just run fine. Okay, so that's just something to be aware of there. Now, hopefully, if we refresh that, what we should see is, if I double-click, we still get that little bounce, okay, but the screen doesn't actually move, okay? So it'll scroll up and down, but won't. It locks it into the middle of the screen, make it much more usable for the end user. Luckily, on the main website here, it still renders correctly, okay? So it only affects the mobile browsers. Flip back to here. Okay, so the next thing I want to talk about is web applications. Now, these are distinct, I make a distinction between mobile websites or websites that have been enabled for mobile versus what seems to be a new trend around web applications. Now, the distinction I make here is that these web applications are still using web technologies, they still serve up HTML and JavaScript, etc. But once you go to the site and you download the first bit of HTML and the corresponding JS, everything else runs locally. Okay, so it actually downloads everything it needs, like it would an application, and runs locally within the context of the browser. Now, sure, it might go back to a server and download some data, and, you know, I'm not saying that it could never go back and download additional HTML, but the majority of the application actually runs in the context of the browser. So what we're starting to see is people are thinking using the browser as just another client technology. So they're actually building whole applications that sit within the context of the browser. And these are just two examples of where companies have started to do that. Now, the interesting thing is that one of the reasons why this has come about is actually Apple's greediness about trying to get transaction revenue through iTunes. Okay, so a lot of people like Amazon with Kindle have said, we're not going to pay you that money. Okay, we make barely enough money to get through with books anyhow, so we're not going to pay you 30% of everything that we sell. Okay, so we're going to actually come up with a web application that works as nicely as the proper iOS application for Kindle. Except it now means that we can transact on the web, okay? So we don't have to go through the iTunes And you'll see here that this is the Kindle Reader. It's actually running just in Chrome, okay? But it runs exactly the same on the iPad, iOS, runs on Android. And you can see that they're starting to use that as their method for going cross-platform. And you'll see as I iterate through this, it's all running locally, okay? Another example of this is the TechEd New Zealand website. And you'll see here, as I navigate through this, and this has been styled for iOS, okay, you'll see that there is no postback here. As I go through all of these, the content is all sitting locally on this. If I flip back just to the Kindle Reader for a second, one thing you'll notice, it would help if I got hit the right button, tools, view source. You'll notice that the source of this is incredibly short. Okay, there's very little HTML in there. Okay, the majority of it actually sits within one of these links. Let me see if I can find it. The Kindle app min.js. Okay, so there's a ton of JS there. And the majority of what it does is it goes off and looks for all of the books that you've signed up for or that you've purchased, and it downloads all of that content locally, uses DOM storage or web storage to basically store that information so that you can iterate through the pages without it having to round trip back to the server. Okay. The next form is hybrid applications. Okay, so we've gone from websites, okay, so really easy strategy, to web applications where we're building the whole thing in the browser. Now we're going the next step and we're saying, okay, well, actually we still want to integrate with the hardware, or another reason would be we still want a presence in the App Store. Okay, if we're going down those paths, then one of the strategies is that we can actually package HTML actually inside the application. Okay, so rather than deploying an application that's going to just show a mobile website actually within an application, we can actually say, okay, well, I'm going to package the HTML, I'm going to package the JS, I'm going to package the CSS. And this is, you could think of this as the early forms of web applications, okay? And this is particularly, this took off on the Symbian platform particularly, where they had a very strong following of building widgets, okay? So, and I'll show you an example of that in a minute. One of the nice things that most of the rich platforms, so iOS, Android, and Windows Phone, support is the ability to integrate between the native application and the web technology that you're running within the browser. Okay, so here we can see an example of if I'll use a web browser control, render some HTML, so I'll just load a page there. Now I can actually communicate back and forth between that. So I can say, okay, I'm going to invoke a particular script within the web page, okay? And it can go off and do something. It could actually be used to modify the look and feel of the page. And then when the script's done, or when I need to communicate back out to the application, I can then call window.external.notify, and actually that will raise an event on the web browser control, and I can pick up that in my managed application. Now, I'm using Windows Phone as an example, but this is true of both iOS and Android as well. You can integrate with the web browser control for those platforms and do a very similar sort of thing.
Both.
So I'll show you an example of both. Yeah. Okay. So we're going to flip over to this project. Okay. And we'll ignore this one for a second. Now this is just a normal vanilla file new project, Windows Phone project. Okay. I haven't changed it at all. Okay. What I am going to do is just rip out some of this, the initial XAML. Okay. And we're going to come over here and grab some XAML from here. Okay, it's very simple. It's a web browser control, okay, and all I'm doing is setting the source on this to a mobile website. Now, the mobile website, I'll just show you very quickly, looks like this. Okay, so it's the 9MSN tipping website results that's been specifically styled for mobile, right? But I'm going to render this within my application, so I don't want the 9MSN banner at the top. Okay, so what I'm going to do is I can come down here and actually say, okay, well, what element is that banner? Okay, so I can see down here that, okay, well, it's the first A tag in there, and basically, if I was to set the display style on that to none, it would disappear, right? So maybe I can run some JavaScript in the web browser that actually goes and sets that to none, which means that all of a sudden my managed application can inject things actually into the web page and customize the style. So I don't have to modify anything on the server side to actually restyle it for Windows Phone. I can actually essentially hack their website and actually restyle it myself. Okay, so let's actually do that. I'll flip across here, to this project. And what we're going to do is we're going to trap the navigated event. Okay, so I'll go ahead and create the event handler for that. Now flip me to some code. I'm actually going to delete that and copy across some other script. Okay, and the script for this is relatively simple. Okay, so you can see here that I'm doing a get element by tag for the first or getting the A tags, and then I'm setting the first one of those to none. Okay. Now, the reason why I'm establishing this as a function is because when I call this invoke script method down here, I need to pass it in the name of the script that I'm going to run and a parameter. Now, there is no function that does this actually within the JavaScript of the 9MSN web page, right? So what I'm doing here is, that site does understand eval, right? So what I'm doing is I'm passing in a new function and calling eval to evaluate the string and the function that I'm passing in. So that will create the function on the fly. Beautiful thing about JavaScript, and actually go and execute it for me. Okay, so hopefully, if the demo gods are with me, what we should see is that same page rendering, but we should see it without the. And let me just actually set a breakpoint here. So it navigates through to it, and what we see is we've actually trimmed off that first header. Okay, so it's a really easy, it's a really nice way of integrating some web content into your application without having to wait for your web technology people, and quite often that gets stuck in operational stuff, and you know, it'll be like months just to change one little thing so that you can style it for Windows Phone. You can go, oh well, I can do this on the client side. Okay, and this is true for all of the major platforms. Okay, so you can actually go in and inject JavaScript and invoke JavaScript like that. So I said I'd give you an example of both directions. I'll show you very quickly another example of how we can use this. Okay, so let me just drop that out. We'll use a different example here. So this one, we're actually going to load up the Twitter website. Okay. And again, you'll notice here that this time I'm hooking the loaded event. You can use either the loaded event or the navigated one. In certain circumstances, you want to use the loaded one because that will actually execute a little bit later than the navigated one. The navigated one's really good if you don't want the user to see you turning things on and off. So that's why I use it on the 9MSN one. The loaded one is good if you're actually going to be extracting content out of the page because it makes sure that it renders in full before it actually invokes. The other thing you'll notice here is that, firstly, we've enabled scripts. Okay, that's true of both of these examples. But here, we're actually wiring up an event handler to the script notify event. So when JavaScript calls window.external.notify, this is the event that gets raised. Okay, so I'll create the event handler for that. And actually, we'll get rid of this existing code that we had before. And rather than me writing a whole bunch of code, what I'm going to do is just drag this bit of script across. Now, this script's a little bit more involved, okay? And what you'll see here is, again, we're defining a function, but we're going to be grabbing all of the input fields, okay? Now, if you've signed into Twitter, you'll be familiar that it's username, password, okay? So we've got two input fields. And we're going to iterate through those and look for input types of text and password. That makes sense. And what we're going to do is attach event handlers to the unchanged event for those. And you notice here that we're doing... as you scroll over here, what we're doing is every time those event handlers get invoked, we're going to call script event external.notify, and we're going to pass out the value of those source elements. This sounds pretty interesting. So all of a sudden, I've got a mobile application that's hosting a sign-in page to Twitter, which your average user is going to go, great, I can sign into Twitter. Little do they realize that the application's sitting there going, okay, I'm going to steal your username and password. Okay. And what we should see up here, there's another event. Okay, so this is the event handler for the script notify. And I'll put a breakpoint there just so that you can see that it actually does extract that that data for me. Okay, so as expected. And we'll come into here. And this is not my password. But what we'll see is that it saw that I typed 12345. And now my application's got both your username and password. Okay, this is one reason why you don't use OAuth and you don't use authentication within a mobile application. Unfortunately, there's no alternative, right? So everybody who wants to use Twitter or Facebook or LinkedIn or any of the other social networks within their application does exactly this. They actually put a web browser within their application, and then they get the user to sign into that, submits it, and comes back with a token that the application can then use on to access their profile on the user's behalf. Okay, Little do users realize that this is potentially really dangerous. Now, luckily, at least for iOS and Windows Phone, we've got very good marketplace constraints in terms of certification and approval process. And if they do discover that an application does this kind of thing, then they'll, of course, revoke it. But, you know, the user could have extracted 50,000 username and password by that stage, okay? Android level field game, you can go nuts on it. I mean, Google have tried to revoke a couple of applications. They get a lot of grief when they do it. In fact, they get more grief about applications that are misusing people's privileges than they do about revoking them. But there is definitely still the risk there, okay? Which leads us back to the mobile web, by the way, okay? Because you don't suffer that same problem if you're building mobile-enabled websites or web applications for the mobile platforms. Okay, so the other example I wanted to do was a widget example. Okay, so we'll come across here and I'll show you. So this is a widget that's designed for one of the Symbian platforms. Okay, so it's using the WTGT extension, which is their version of the widgets. Now, widgets are actually a W3C sort of standard. Okay, and all it is a zip file. So if I expand that, you'll see it's a zip file containing HTML, JS, and some CSS and some images. Okay, so this is basically packaging everything together that you're going to need to run the application into a zip file. They change the extension just for the platform's sake, and then they deploy it as a package to the mobile platform. They just unzip it on the mobile platform and then run it as a set of files. Okay, it's very similar to if you're building a Windows Phone application, the extension is .zap. It's just a zip file, right? So when it gets deployed to the mobile platform, it actually gets uncompressed before they actually execute it. Now, what we're going to do is actually copy the contents of this zip file across into this other example application I've got here. Okay, so I'll copy the content across there, go back to Visual Studio, and we're actually going to close this application down here. So I'll remove that one. And we're going to use this other example here. Again, the actual application is basically a standard Windows Phone application. I haven't modified it at all. And if I show all files, you'll see that those additional files are now here. So I'll go in and include those. So the CSS, the HTML file, and the JS file are the ones that I'm interested in. So I'll include those in the project. The other thing you want to make sure is that the build action is set to content, okay? Because what you're going to be doing is deploying those with your application, and you want them to exist on the core platform alongside your application. Now, Windows Phone is a bit peculiar in the way that it handles things. Is you can't, even though you've got the HTML and the JavaScript locally on with the application, you can't actually invoke them and load them in the web browser unless they're in isolated storage. So on Windows Phone, there's two parts of storage that your application has. There's the where your zap file gets expanded to, which you've only got read access to, and then you've got isolated storage, which is where your application can read and write to. Okay, so in order for you to render HTML, you actually need to copy it from where it gets installed from into isolated storage. Okay. Luckily, I've got a little bit of code that does that. So we'll go into our main application, main page, and I'll scroll down a little bit. And copy files to isolated storage. So I'll just allow it to add a few references in here. Okay. Thankfully, ReSharp is pretty good at that for me. And I will flip back to our main application, because, of course, we're going to be rendering this in our... we need a web browser to render it in. So, I'll crop out the existing XAML, or the existing layout, and I'm going to copy across our XAML for that. So, actually, I'll grab it from here. And we want script enabled, but we don't actually want any of this existing content in there. Okay, so we've just got a web browser. And on the load for the page, okay, the first thing we're going to do is save the file size isolated storage. This code will be available afterwards, so I won't painfully walk through it, but essentially all I'm going to do is iterate through all of the files that get deployed with the application, look for CSS, JS files, and HTML files, and copy them from the application install folder across to isolated storage. Okay. Then all we're going to do is actually set the browser to navigate to the index.html. So this is the primary file for that for the website. And you'll see down here as part of the output window, we would have seen very, very briefly, build. You'll see all of those files actually being deployed along with the application. Okay, so you can see here that all of the CSS file and the JS file are there as content, okay, rather than being compiled into the application. So we'll allow that to run, and I'll flip over to our web browser. Okay, and again, you can see that it's taken the HTML file and it's rendering it really small. Okay, and it's also sitting there thinking about working. Okay, so there's a couple of issues that we've got to fix there to get this to work. So the first thing is our meta tags. Okay, so they're still relevant here. So I'm going to grab those same meta tags that we used before. I'm going to just grab the second one that we added in. We don't need those two legacy ones because we know we're going to be running on Windows Phone. Windows Phone effectively ignores those if we've got the viewport tag there. The other thing I'm going to do is that you'll notice down here that there's some specific references to some of the existing JavaScript libraries that are available on the Symbian platform. So we're going to actually just replace that with a little bit of our own code. Does exactly the same thing. It looks for just the relevant elements and sets the display property to none or block, depending on whether we want to hide or show them. And then the other thing we need to do is obviously reference those methods and change the content down here. So I'll just change this to app status dot ready, busy. And the same with this one. Okay, let's rerun that. Okay, so an interesting thing here is that it's come up and we're actually trying to use geocoding actually within the this widget. Okay, it's a very basic widget that basically uses your geolocation and goes off to UV Maps and actually tries to download and actually show you the map of where you're currently at. So, of course, it's going to try and access geolocation. Now, one of the nice things about the web browser control within Windows Phone 7.5 is it does actually support geocoding actually within it. So you can basically say, is geolocation enabled? And I say true. Now when we run it up, it should go away and actually pull back the map for where the, well, not where we're located, but where the emulator thinks it's based, okay, which is, of course, Redmond. So that's somewhere in Redmond, USA. Okay, we can flip on the Chicago button. Of course, we've got that same JS ability there, so it's going to go off and render the Chicago maps there. Now, the nice thing here is that we can still do callouts to the core platform in exactly the same way as we did in the previous demo. So this code, we can go in and modify that to do an external call, and we can go ahead and actually capture an image from the camera, or we can integrate with the accelerometer and get feedback from that. So there's a whole raft of things that we can do by integrating with the core platform just using that JS interop level that we just saw in the previous example. Okay. Okay, so web technologies are all very well and good, but they don't necessarily give us the ability to rapidly build applications for a specific platform, nor do they give us the ability to necessarily style it in the same way as the core platform. Okay, we can get pretty close in mobile, most of the websites, but there's still nothing like the native tools. Okay, so primarily these are for Windows Phone, they're Visual Studio and Expression Blend. Okay, Expression Blend being the design tool. For iOS, it's of course Xcode and their corresponding interface builder. Now with Xcode 4, they're one and the same. They've been integrated together. And then of course for Android, you're based in Eclipse, okay, doing Java. So I'll give you a very simple example of Windows Phone 7, and I'll show you I guess the reason I wanted to show this example is just to give you an idea of just the difference in usability of the technologies versus building for the web, and how you can go about rapidly building applications. Okay, so again, we use this same application, and what we're going to do, actually, no, I'll just close this one, and we'll just go File, New Project, Add New Project. So, brand new Windows Phone application. And I will immediately flip over to using Expression Blend. Okay. So the tools are kind of aware of each other, and they use exactly the same project files and solution files, which is nice. Okay, so we can do fit selection. I can go ahead and create sample data set. And I apologize if you saw this demo on Wednesday when I gave it. It's the same demo. Okay, so what we're going to be doing is showing a list of image captures and the corresponding comments for people who have taken photos during TechEd. Okay, and so what we're going to do is we want some sample data that mirrors that. Okay, so we've got an image and we've got a comment. And now that we've got that sample data, you can actually go in and modify the sample data if you want. Okay, so if you've got a set of images that are related to your application, you can actually go and change these images and basically say, okay, pick the sample images from this folder. Okay, I'm going to leave it with the default ones because I'm pretty happy with those. And I'm just literally going to drag this captures list across here. Okay, I don't particularly like the way it's formatted that, so I'm going to play with it a little bit. I can go in here and it's already pre-generated a template for each one of those rows for me. But I'm going to go in and modify that template and just reorganize things just slightly. So I'll go ahead and say, okay, well, at the moment it's vertically stacking things. So I'm going to change that to a horizontal stack. And I'm just going to space it out just a little bit to give it a bit more room to breathe, both horizontally and vertically. Okay, so you can see the immediate design time experience that we've got within Expression Blend there. Okay, of course, we want to make sure that the sample data doesn't appear at runtime, so we uncheck this box, okay? And I'm not sure why it just decided to revert my changes back over here. By doing that. The magic of Expression Blend, it does have a little bit of a mind of its own sometimes. Okay, so for some reason, toggling that option decided to change it for a split second. Okay, so we've done the layout. Let's actually go and actually write some code to actually populate that. Now, I said that they're kind of aware of each other. Unfortunately, they're not super aware of each other. So when you flip between the two, you will get this annoying dialogue that says, do you want to reload it? And it's like, yes, I'm aware of that change. Okay, so we'll go ahead and actually load the main page again. Come back to here. Now, so that I can share code between this application and other applications for other platforms, I'm actually going to write the code to actually go off to the service in a different file. I'm going to go add new class, capture helper, and I'm going to crop this out and write some code. Well, I'm just going to copy some code and then we'll walk through it. Let me just add some references so that this stuff works properly. Double check that we've got everything we need. We do need to add a reference to system.xml.link. All right. And now hopefully. All our build errors are almost gone. Excellent. So, This code, okay, it's very straightforward. There's a single method here, which is called download captures, and we're going to create a web request to this URL. So let me just show you what that actually brings back. Okay, this brings back basically an XML feed. It's an atom feed of entities, and you'll see as we scroll down there, the details of these entities include a URL for the image, which is this long thing here coming off the CDN, and a description for the comment. Which is the text that went with it. Okay, so this is basically a series of those capture items. Okay, we're going to be processing those in code. Now, there seems to be an issue with the current build of the monitors where the JSON deserializer doesn't work, so I've actually elected to just use XML parsing here. But you could quite easily, because it's no data feeds coming through WCF data services, you can quite easily say, give me JSON, okay, and actually decode that in your application. And that's actually a lot quicker. The other thing you can do if you're specifically targeting Windows Phone is Windows Phone actually does have native support for OData as well. So you can do add new service reference, point it at the OData feed, and then it gives you really nice link expressions to code over. Unfortunately, that when we're talking cross-platform and we want to reuse our code, that's not going to port properly across those platforms because they're still evolving the mono tools that we'll talk about in a minute. So once we've decoded those, we're actually going to there's a callback method that gets passed into this download method. Okay, so this action. With capture data. So once we've done parsing the downloaded data, we're actually going to call that callback so that our application can make use of the returned data set. Okay. So of course, we're going to call that from our application. So I'll come in here and copy this code across. It's very simple code. Okay. So it basically handles the loaded event for the main page and goes ahead and actually calls the download captures method. Okay. Once it's done, it actually sets the returned data set as the data context for the page. And for those who work with Windows Phone, you will be familiar that once you've set the data context for the page, that data context will flow down to every element within the page. So it means that the data binding that we did across in Blend will actually pick up that data context and it will look for the captures property within that. Okay, so again, if the demo gods are with me, what we should see is that this will actually go and replace our sample data set with real data set coming from the web. Okay, so this is basically the list that we laid out previously. Okay, now I can go and modify that query across here. It's just a matter of coming in here and modifying the URL that we're actually requesting. I mean, that's one of the really nice things about OData is that all of the queries there are specified across the on the command line on the URL. And I'll just rerun this, actually targeting Australia, so you can actually see some images that kind of make sense rather than the test images from last week. Okay. So you can see here that some people have been downloading the images from or uploading images from the party last night. Okay, so we'll show in a minute how we can then reuse that same code across the other platforms. The other option we've got is to go native. Okay, now, when I was Googling it, or Bing it, I should say, the first thing that reference I came up with was C for Dummies. Okay, so obviously some people are going out there, how do I learn how to do native code? So, good starting point. Now, the other reason that this is up here is that increasingly native developers are finding it becoming harder and harder to get access to, and they're relatively expensive. So going down this road does give you some advantages. It gives you performance, okay, and it gives you the ability to reuse code in a very efficient way between iOS and Android. Unfortunately, the downside is that the other mobile platforms don't, or a lot of them, don't allow you to run native code on them anymore. Okay, so Windows Phone, there is no support for native code. Okay, so it is a little bit of a limitation in terms of which platforms you can target. But if you're really looking for a serious amount of grunt in your application, so you're doing like 3D rendering and that type of thing, it's definitely something that's worth considering. Go and find yourself some expensive C++ or C developer and paying them an army load of money to make you some money on those platforms. In terms of frameworks and tools, there's a couple of frameworks that are emerging. So the guys from Zamirin, I can never pronounce their name properly, it's basically the guys who have taken responsibility for the Mono project. They've got a tool called MonoTouch, which focuses on doing iPhone development and iPad development. And then they've got MonoDroid for Android development. And they don't have a Mono for Windows Phone because, well, Windows Phone does Silverlight, so they don't need to have their own runtime there. So it's basically, if you want to go down the C# path, so you've got .NET skills internally, I'd highly recommend you having a look at that. It's not great for every application, and there's definitely some performance trade-offs and some trade-offs that you're making there on the platform, but you do get a good level of reuse on your existing code base there. The nice thing about the way that they've done it is that the UI layer is something that you still need to do specifically for each of the platforms, and I'll show you that in a minute. Another strategy is the strategy adopted by both App Accelerator, which is Titanium, for those people who have seen it, and PhoneGap, is the concept of, again, taking web technologies. And in the case of App Accelerator, what they do is they take that web technology in the JS and they actually cross-compile the JS to native code and to code specific for the platform. PhoneGap takes a slightly different approach where they basically do the interop layer that we just saw a minute ago in terms of integrating with the core features through that JavaScript interop layer. Okay, so they don't do as much cross-compilation to the native platform as the guys from App Accelerator. Okay, I just want to quickly show you an example of the same application that we had before. But this time we're actually going to do it as an Android application on here. So we're going to add new project. And you'll see Mono for Android. The nice thing about what they've done here is that you can use either Mono Develop, which is the free version of Visual Studio, or you can it actually integrates into Visual Studio. So you can do Mono for Android application. I'm not going to bother renaming it. And you'll see that immediately we're in here. Nice things are that because we're integrated in Visual Studio, I even get resharper support as I go through and write my lines of code as well. So it's a really nice experience from a writing code perspective point of view. And I can come up here and say, okay, well, I don't want to recode that helper class that I had, so I'm just going to add that existing item. Okay, so I'll come back, go across to my phone application, and say, okay, there's my capture helper. I pressed OK too quickly. Let me just delete that and actually show you what I meant to do, which is add existing item. Click on the item and then hit the add as link. Okay, so the nice thing about this is we're now going to be sharing that code file between the two. Okay, so it means if I modify it in one place, I'm going to modify it in both. So we're starting to get some... it means that we can maintain one set of code base as opposed to maintaining three different parts. Okay. So we'll actually make use of that now. Now, I'm just going to check that builds, which I suspect it won't because it's whinging about a whole bunch of things. So I'll come in here. Now, there's actually it's whinging that it can't find system.windows. Okay, we're not going to be running on Windows. Luckily, this file, I can actually get rid of all of these unused directives. So nice thing about Resharp, it'll do that for me. And now what we should see is it'll only have a few errors. And these are basically saying, okay, I've got to go and add some references to my Android application. So I'll go add reference, I'll whiz down here and go, okay, I need, I think, these three to get this stuff to work. Okay, so it's successfully built now. Now, obviously, we haven't wired that up to anything. So let me actually go and have a look at the UI layer for Android. You'll notice that the folder structure is a little bit peculiar to Android. But they've done it in a way that they provide some very nice wrappers for the layout. So you'll notice here, if I drill into here, it's got two items here. It's got a linear layout with a button in it. We're going to replace that with a grid. Okay, so this is going to be a grid going down the page of the various items. And what you'll see in our code is that down here it was initially referencing this resource.layout.main. Okay, so that's a way for it to reference the contents of that main.xaml file. So it's providing some rich runtime information for us. So again, we get the IntelliSense because they provided that wrapper around those four within Visual Studio for us. Okay, let's actually go down here and we're going to change some code here. The way that they do the integration between a grid or a set of, like, effectively a list, okay, is that in order to populate the list, we need a table adapter. Okay, so we'll grab one of those, okay, rather than walking through writing lines and lines of code. I'll add the service reference there. So you'll see that this base adapter, you can call this whatever you like. It doesn't have to be a text adapter. Okay, the name's not that relevant. Okay, the important thing is that you're providing feedback as to, you know, how many items they're going to be in there. Okay, and for each of those items, it's got this get view method. Okay, so it basically queries it and says, okay, what's the view going to be for this item? The nice thing about this model is that you can completely customize each item in the grid as it goes down. Okay, the downside is that you have to write code to do it. Okay, whereas in Expression Blend, we were basically able to set up the template and actually visualize it actually within the designer experience. Okay, we're going to make use of that text adapter up here. Okay, so there is no button anymore, so we'll get rid of that. We'll grab some other code, which basically looks for the grid that we've added. Okay, so it's looking for that particular grid view. It's coming up red at the moment because I haven't done a build. Okay, once I do a build, I'll actually go and find that grid view that we've added into the layout. And you'll get that strongly typedness about it. Okay, the last thing I need to add in here is the ability to wire up that table adapter and to actually go and get the content for me. Okay, so again, the same call out to download captures. Okay, and you'll see that once it comes back, we're calling the update capture method on the table adapter. Okay, so bear in mind that when the application runs up, it will go to the text adapter and it will actually load the contents at that point. Okay, of which there is none because it hasn't got any data down. Okay. Once we've got the data back, we're going to call to the table adapter and say, okay, well, we've got new data now. Okay, refresh what the view looks like. Okay, and you'll see the method down here does exactly that. This capture update capture sets the data within the adapter and then calls this notified dataset changed method. Okay, so that basically propagates an event up to refresh the UI. Okay, now if I hit play at the moment, what you will see is it will come up and say, okay, well, I know that you need to run this on an Android device. Okay, it's actually detected my Android device here. You can actually go ahead and start an emulator image if you want. I'm not going to do that because the emulators for Android seem to be particularly flaky and particularly back on Android 2.3, whereas the actual device seems to be a lot more stable. So what I will do is I'll just cancel that and let me just set a breakpoint before we do that, just so you believe that it works. I'll actually run that up, and I'll run it up on here. I do apologize again, we don't have a visualizer, so you can't actually see it unless you're in the front row. The other thing you'll notice about the device versus the emulator is that it takes about 3 minutes to deploy and run onto the emulator. It takes about 30 seconds to run to the device, so it's significantly quicker to run on a real device. And the nice thing about Android devices is they're cheap. Okay, so you can go and get one, and it's worth doing that. It'll save you hours of time. Okay, so notice it's deployed my Windows Phone app as well. But I don't think it's actually, didn't set the startup project. Let's actually set that to run. Hopefully it's going to get there eventually. Okay, so we finally hit our breakpoint. If I run that, and the guys in the front row can verify that there's text on the screen. Okay, so it has actually gone off and actually downloaded and run it. So it does work. Okay, let me see if I can do the same thing. And I'm not going to write code this time, but I do have it running on iOS as well. Okay, so here we've got the same code. Okay, so this is our Capture Helpers class. Okay. It's gone blank. Okay, there we go. So same code. Okay, so again, we're downloading it, we're parsing it in XML. Okay, and in our main.cs file, I'm on the finishing launching method. I'm actually going to go and call the download captures method. And I've got a simple breakpoint that I'm going to put here to actually report the number of items that are in there. I haven't actually gone to the point of wiring up the UI, just to demonstrate this actually works. The nice thing about this is, again, this is actually mono develop, okay, for that runs on macOS. Okay, you do need to run it on macOS for doing iPhone development. But you'll find that the experience in mono develop is actually very similar to Visual Studio for doing code editing. Okay, so let me just run this on the emulator. Now, one of the things I noticed with the move to Line is that you can be sitting here for hours waiting for that to actually start the debugger. You actually need to flip across to the simulator in order for it to start invoking. It's true multitasking, yes, as Steve Jobs would say. So actually, that breakpoint didn't actually hit, because it's on a missing line. But you can see down in the code editor window here, it's actually brought back 16 items. Okay, so that's the console.write line there. Okay, so it does work. Now, the other thing I wanted to show you here is just the integration that they've done with the existing tools for iPhone development. So if I double-click on this, it should flip across and actually loads up Interface Builder for iPhone development. So this is their design tool. Okay, it's a little bit more clunky than the one for Expression Blend, but that level of integration means that you can start to do your UI layout using the tools that are designed to do UI layout for iPhone or iOS development, and then it integrates and they provide that wrapping layer in Mono Develop, so you can capture events and you can integrate properly with the UI controls. They're all name controls and stuff like that, and it all flows through to C#. There are some elements where you might come across a control that somebody's written or a library that you want to access, and there is a very well-documented strategy for actually including those within your project as well. You have to write a little bit of the wrapper code that provides that interrupt layer between the mono-develop stuff and the actual code that you brought into your application. But don't feel that you're necessarily limited by the wrapping functions that they've given there. So the thing there is that iOS continues to evolve. These guys evolve at a different rate. If you find that there's a function that iOS has that's not already part of the wrapper that they provide, you can go ahead and wrap that. And that's true of Android, the MonoDroid wrapper as well. So let me flip back to, what am I on, two? Okay, some closing thoughts. Okay, the developer mindshare, as we saw earlier, is approximately 67 Android, followed by iOS, followed by the mobile web. The mobile web seems to be the one that's emerging and growing over time. It's interesting to see that the platform's being abandoned, Symbian and Java ME. It would be interesting to see with the partnership between Nokia and Microsoft around Windows Phone and where that strategy goes, and how many people start to move across to Windows Phone and doing Windows Phone development because they see an opportunity to capitalize on that. Symbian probably won't go away for those sort of developing nations and those scenarios, so I think that there's still an opportunity there for those market segments as well. The interesting thing there is just the choice for platform development. This mobile web seems to be moving from out here all the way up to being, it'll be number one or number two by the end of the year, I'd imagine, because it seems to be the trend that a lot of people are following. Okay. I'll leave this on the screen just so that if you haven't already captured it, you can, and I'll open the floor for questions. Thank you very much for attending. So. Okay, so the question at the front was how likely is an application to be passed through the marketplace, and sorry, I'll get out of your way, if you use, for example, Monotouch and Monodroid?
We're looking at using one that's just a WebKit that uses HTML5.
Okay. So something like PhoneGap or Titanium, yep. So those ones, as far as I'm aware, are being passed through okay. I know Windows Phone's got some weird constraint about just having an app that's just a shell for a mobile site. But if you're actually packaging the content within the application, they view that as being okay. So there are a few little gotchas around those. But as far as I'm aware, that's fine. The stuff around Monodroid and Monotouch actually... So Apple came out last year and basically said that you have to use their tools and their frameworks for building for their platforms. Now, that only lasted for a 3 to 4 month period, and during that time, they did not reject a single Monotouch developed application. Okay, now they've since relaxed that, and they've opened it up again for those technologies.
But is that
they were really targeting the Adobe platforms and try to prevent people from using those tools. Yep. So, yep. As far as that's as far as I'm aware. Yeah, and you know the Mono guys basically came out and in retort to Apple and basically said, you look at some of the best performing applications on the marketplace, they're actually written in Monotouch. The reason being is that memory management up until recently has been a real pain for Objective-C developers to get their head around. Okay, it's not simple. Okay, once you get your head around it, it's not too hard to manage. But it is a bit of a mind shift from people coming from very managed platforms like C# or Java to get across, come back to a native platform and having to go, okay, well, do I own this object or was it created for me? And you know, and even people coming from C and C++, coming into Objective-C, where Objective-C tries to do a bit of that management for you, and there is definitely some rules about when you release objects and when you capture them and things like that. It requires a bit of getting your head around that platform. And you know, a lot of errors in iPhone applications, and the reason why they crash is missed memory allocation. So the Mono guys basically said, "Look, we've done all the heavy lifting for you. You know, we do garbage collection. We pick up those objects when you dispose of them, and when you get you've stopped using them. We've done all the memory management for you. We've tested it and thoroughly tested it, and it's been used in thousands of applications, and you know, they've done it in a very good way. So a lot of good feedback. Yep." So you're talking about Phone 7 or... Yeah, Phone 7, it was very, very conservative as to how frequently it ran on Phone 7. That was basically because it was Compact Framework, and Compact Framework was a single pass or multiple pass rather than a generational garbage collection. So it would really only run when you ran out of memory. Now, the problem with Windows Phone is that there's a marketplace requirement that says you've got to be under 90 megs. Once you're at 90 megs, you're nowhere near the 256 or 512K megs of RAM that's actually available on the device. So the garbage collector's got no incentive to run, right? So it goes, I don't need to run. So what you'd find is that if you're using the panorama or the pivot, when you come back, you know, you go back and forth, all of a sudden you're well over the 90 meg, and you actually have to call gc.collect. With Windows Phone Mango, they've changed that to generational. Okay, so you'll see actually in the performance tool, you'll see the GC kicking in at the first level quite frequently. So it's got a lot better. There may still be some scenarios where it's not as aggressive as it perhaps needs to be. Again, because the GC doesn't actually know about that 90 meg limit. It doesn't know when you're approaching the 90 megs. Okay, so there is a little bit of a problem there, but it's got a lot better. Yeah. The other platforms, what they encourage is that whenever you're not using an object, if it's disposable, call dispose and be aggressive about calling dispose. So make sure you're always using statements and always actively disposing of objects if you can, because that just encourages the layers to go and release those objects as well. There's definitely with Monodroid, there are some performance hits of addressing going through the various interrupt layers there. That they're continually work to try and improve those. So you would have seen that it actually took quite a while for it to come back with the data and parse the data when we ran it on the Android device. Okay, so. Alrighty? Yeah, yeah, go.
Do you see any Kinect type technologies coming in?
Perhaps. I mean, we're definitely seeing some sort of 3D technologies coming into phones. Whether we'll see sort of vision and detection and swipes and stuff like that, I don't know yet. It's quite a long one. Increasingly they do, yeah. Especially if you try and offload some of that power to a back end. The Kinect does what it does particularly well because it typically only does recognition across a very limited subset of identities. So, you know, you probably have 5 or 6 people registered with a Kinect, so it's very easy for it to do. Well, I wouldn't say it's easy, but they can do that across, you know, 6 people and work out whether it's you or me. And if it's an unknown, they go, I don't know who you are. If you were to try and register every person at this conference and then try and run that through a Kinect, it would be a lot slower. So, other questions? Shoot. There are definitely differences, yeah. It's not supported on Windows Phone, for a start. The difference is primarily a syntactical, for the difference that I've seen, because I did some work with iOS and what was Windows Mobile, because that actually supported, they had a version of OpenGL for that. And some of it was, so it was syntactical just because Objective-C has different syntax to C#. But also in terms of some of the implementations were slightly different as well. So I wouldn't say it's a specification difference as opposed to an implementation difference. So things like alpha transparency and things like that was handled differently on Windows Mobile versus iOS. Unfortunately, the situation we're in is that particularly for games developers, it's a bit of a pain because both iOS and Android support OpenGL, whereas Windows Phone, there's no equivalent to Open. Well, the equivalent is XNA, okay, and they're just different coordinate system, different way of doing things, so it's not compatible. So, I mean, there's definitely some projects underway to do that translation as such, but it's not easy stuff because if you think about every single model that you're using within your game or your application, you've got to invert those coordinates, and it's like that's insane. So you've basically got to keep multiple copies of each of those resources and stuff like that. So I don't necessarily like that. I think that Microsoft could do a better job of making it easier for OpenGL developers to come across. But I guess their attitude is that, you know, they wanted to provide a mechanism to get Xbox developers across onto the phone and start building awesome games that way. So, which they've done. You know, they've got very good cross-platform development from within the Microsoft-centric world. If you go, you know, Windows Phone, Windows Desktop, Xbox, effectively you're building with the same set of XNA technologies. And we're starting to see that in the Silverlight space as well. I mean, we're seeing an emergence of Silverlight across all of those platforms. Did you see Chris Wallace's session yesterday on XNA? Yeah, so he talks about actually not just XNA, but also the integration between Silverlight and XNA on Windows Phone. So because one of the problems that we saw time and time again from game developers is they want to present a menu of, you know, for settings and things like that, and they'd have to manually code that up in XNA because it's all line-by-line code and then accept user input, work it whether it's in a button or stuff. And that's like, I just want to show a button on the screen, you know, whereas now with the integration with Silverlight, you can do the button and the form layout in Silverlight and then have your XNA running the actual game. So it's really nice there. So it's, you know, it's all about having those 3D teapots running in my application. All right, any other questions? SQLite. Okay, so SQLite's across all the 3 platforms. There's a version for Windows Phone. Unfortunately, there's not, no. So you kind of have to do the parsing yourself. And the SQLite libraries are pretty good at giving you, they'll give you rows and columns, and you have to basically parse those out into objects. So it's not as efficient as going, you know, link to SQL, give me an object back, you know, and it doing all of the wrapping for you. And unfortunately, the direction they've gone with link to SQL means that it's very difficult to provide that compatibility between Windows Phone 7 using SQL CE and other applications using SQLite. So it's not like I could reuse my select statements across them because, you know, SQL Compact will require you to write that as a link statement. As opposed to as just a select statement, which is a little painful, I think. It would have been nice if they provide us a way of doing at least low-level select statements. But yeah, definitely SQLite is the way to go for that.
So.
Yes, the major things they've provided wrappers for are in terms of MonoTouch and MonoDroid, so that's not a problem. And if there are other things that are not provided as wrappers, then you just have to write your own wrapper down to it. So you'll probably have to delve in and write some Objective-C that provides that wrapper layer and exposes it in a way that MonoTouch can accept it. There's some pretty good blog posts out there from the guys from Mono talking about how you do that. So go to their website. They've actually started to produce some really good documentation. They've got some really good tutorials. So can anybody actually pronounce that? Xamarin, is it? Okay, cool. I keep thinking, what's that name of the company that now runs it? Like, they could have come up with a more memorable one. All right, I'm going to actually have to hold it there because I actually got another session on Windows Azure with Windows Phone coming up. So thanks very much, guys.